Time to begin. I assume I'm audible. Good. We're stuck in the Eumaeus episode. They talk about Parnell and his divorce case, where it was found out that he had an affair with a married woman, Kitty O'Shea. And of course, the Irish wouldn't like them. She's the English woman. That
Rita Shaw?
Pardon?
Sorry.
The English woman that, in a way, brought Parnell low. In some editions, the minority, the one that is established, Gabler, with a small print, there is a line that was taken out.
Come on.
A line that was taken out, and sorry, I'm confused now. It was taken out, and the line said, "She, Kitty O'Shea, loosened many a man's thighs." Somehow it didn't get into the 1922 edition, and this would have been a reference, a Homeric reference in. In the Iliad, it says when somebody died, the god loosened his thighs. But here she opened many of my thighs, has of course a sexual meaning that isn't there, just to get this out of the way. But now we go on, come to Broome, who of course doesn't like the direction the discussion is taking, because it had to do with an adulterous affair. Good.
This gratuitous contribution of a humorous character occasioned a fair amount of laughter among his entourage.
He merely
gazed in the direction of the door and reflected upon the historic story, which had aroused extraordinary interest at the time, when the facts, to make matters worse, were made public with the usual affectionate letters that passed between them, full of sweet nothings. First, it was strictly platonic, till nature intervened and an attachment sprang up between them, till bit by bit matters came to a
climax
in the talk of the town, till the staggering blow came, as a welcome intelligence to not a few evil-disposed, however, who resolved upon encouraging his downfall, though the thing was public property all along, though not to anything like the sensational extent that it subsequently blossomed into. Since their names were coupled, though, since he was her declared favourite, where was the particular necessity to proclaim it to the rank and file from the housetops, the fact, namely, that he had shared her bedroom, which came out in the witness box on oath, when a thrill went through the packed court, literally electrifying everybody in the shape of witnesses, swearing to have witnessed him on such and such a particular date in the act of scrambling out of an upstairs apartment with the assistance of a ladder in night apparel, having gained admittance in the same fashion, a fact that the weeklies, addicted to the lubric a little, simply coined shoals of money out of. Whereas the simple fact of the case was, it was simply a case of the husband not being up to the scratch, with nothing in common between them beyond the name, and then a real man arriving on the scene, strong to the verge of weakness, falling a victim to her siren charms and forgetting home ties. The usual sequel, to bask in the loved one's smiles. The eternal question of the life connubial, needless to say, cropped up. Can real love, supposing there happens to be another chap in the case, exist between married folk? Though it was no concern of theirs, absolutely, if you regarded her with affection, carried away by a wave of folly. A magnificent specimen of manhood he was, truly, augmented, obviously, by gifts of a high order, as compared with the other military supernumerary, that is, who was just the usual everyday farewell my gallant captain kind of an individual in the light dragoons, the 18th Hussars, to be accurate, and inflammable, doubtless, the fallen leader, that is, not the other, in his own peculiar way, which she, of course, woman, quickly perceived as highly likely to carve his way to fame, which he almost bid fair to do, till the priests and ministers of the gospel as a whole, his erstwhile staunch adherents and his beloved evicted tenants, for whom he had done yeoman service in the rural parts of the country by taking up cudgels on their behalf, in a way that exceeded their most sanguine expectations, very effectually cooked his matrimonial goose, thereby heaping coals of fire on his head, much in the same way as the fable ass's kick. Looking back now, in a retrospective kind of arrangement, all seemed a kind of dream. And the coming back was the worst thing you ever did, because it went without saying you would feel out of place, as things always moved with the times. Why, as he reflected, Irish Town Strand, a locality he had not been in for quite a number of years, looked different somehow since, as it happened, he went to reside on the north side. North or south, however, it was just a well-known case of hot passion, pure and simple, upsetting the apple cart with a vengeance, and just bore out the very thing he was saying, as she also was Spanish, or half so, types that wouldn't do things by halves, passionate abandon of the south, casting every shred of decency to the winds.
Again, we have the usual style, a bit overdone with lots of idioms that don't quite fit together. This gratuitous contribution of a humorous character occasioned a fair amount of laughter among his entourage. That's because Bloom, he, and again it wouldn't be necessary, Bloom without the faint would just as well do. He, without the faintest suspicion of a smile, obviously Bloom doesn't smile, merely gazed into the direction of the door and reflected upon the historic story, also not a very good turn of phrase, which had aroused extraordinary interest at the time when the facts, to make matters worse, were made public. With the usual affectionate letters that passed between them, full of sweet nothings. The Parnell case, the fact that he was in an adulterous relationship, had of course come out in the court, where you have to, tell the truth. Full of sweet nothings. First, Bloom thinks, it was strictly platonic, till nature intervened, and an attachment sprung up between them, till, bit by bit, matters came to a climax, and the matter became the talk of the town, till the staggering blow came as a welcome intelligence news. To not a few evil-disposed, however, who were resolved upon encouraging his downfall, though the thing was public property all along. Parnell's downfall was also when this became known that some members, obviously good Catholic members, disapproved of his behavior, and there was a split in the party. No, not to anything like the sensational extent that it subsequently blossomed into. Since their names were coupled, though, since he was declared favourite, where was the particular necessity to proclaim it to the rank and file from the housetops? The fact, namely, that he had shared her bedroom, which came out in the witness box on oath. As I said, you have to say things under oath. When a thrill went through the packed court, literally affecting everybody. Now, of course, you know, you see the use of literally, which is used in the sense of not literally, really, because nobody was electrified. Electrifying everybody in the shape of witnesses swearing to have witnessed him on such and such a particular date, in the act of scrambling out of an upstairs apartment with the addition of a ladder in night apparel. It came out, or it was reported, that wasn't true, that Parnell, when the couple was disturbed, for the police came or something, that he escaped through the fire escape in his nightshirt. That was a rumor that we now know isn't true, but that's what was being said. Having gained admittance in the same fashion, a fact, again the word fact is always a bit odd, that the weeklies, addicted to the lubric a while, simply coined shoals of money out of. Whereas the simple fact of the case was simply a case, of the husband not being up to the scratch, with nothing in common between them beyond the name, and then a real man arriving on the scene, strong to the verge of weakness, falling a victim to her siren charms, and forgetting home ties. Usual sequel, to bask in the love one smiles. The eternal question of the life connubial, needless to say, that's a common phrase here, cropped up. And Mirloff, supposing there happens to be another chap in the case, exists between married folk. That's, of course, something that would occupy Bloom. Though it was no concern of theirs, absolutely, if he regarded her with affection, carried away by a wave of folly. A magnificent specimen of manhood was truly that Parnell, who must have been an imposing figure, augmented, obviously, by gifts of higher order, as compared with the other military super, that would be Captain O'Shea, the legal husband. That is, who was just the usual, everyday, farewell, my gallant captain, the song kind of individual in the Light Dragoons, the 18th Hussars, to be accurate. So he was an officer, major. And inflammable, doubtless, the false leader, that is, not the other. In this chapter, it's very hard to define the identity of somebody. And here, it just corrects a possible misunderstanding. It's the fallen leader who is not, who is an imposing figure. In his own peculiar way, which she, of course, woman, quickly perceived as highly likely to carve his way to fame. Now, of course, he was already famous, which he almost bid fair to do, till the priests and ministers of the gospel as a whole, so that the church turned against him, and his erstwhile staunch adherents, some members of his own party, and his beloved evicted tenants, for whom he had done yeoman service. A big issue in the 19th century politics was the evicted tenants, when the tenants who were very poor peasants couldn't pay the rent. They were evicted and lost their livelihood, and it was a big issue that was taken up by Parnell, by taking up the cudgel on their behalf, so even some of them decided against him in a way that exceeded their most sanguine expectations, very effectually cooked his matrimonial goose. To cook somebody's goose means to destroy it, and you get a strange kind of, to cook a matrimonial goose. So the assemblage of idioms and cliches sometimes have a strange effect. By the way, as you can imagine, I may have said that, this kind of chapter is very hard to translate, because you have to recreate the intended wrongness. And of course, it's very hard for a translator to make it clear that it was not his or her particular failure, but it was a characteristic of the style. Thereby heaping coals of fire on his head, much in the same way as the fabled arse's kick. There must be a fable about the arse kicking. Looking back now in a retrospective kind of arrangement, you know, this phrase turns up quite often, the retrospective kind of arrangement, all seemed a kind of dream. And the coming back, and this, the last chapters are concerned with the coming back, like Odysseus returning. And the coming back was the worst thing you ever did, because it went without saying, you would feel out of place, and things always move with the times. So coming back isn't always a good thing. Why, as he reflected, Irishtown Strand, a locality he had not been for quite a number of years, he probably ought to mean. He himself had come back to a place that he knew formerly. Looked different somehow since, as it happened, he went to reside on the north side. Bloom has had many apartments, many houses, and he moved around there quite a bit. Now he lives on the north side, and the north side of Dublin is considered the poorer side. North or south, however, it was just a well-known case of hot passion, pure and simple, upsetting the apple cart with a vengeance. And just all out the very thing I was saying, and we don't quite know, by the way, whether all of this is spoken to Stephen or only thought of. The chapter doesn't make the distinction. Sometimes we know. Just pour out the very thing he was saying, as she also was Spanish, or half so. Catherine O'Shea was not Spanish, but Bloom heard some kind of rumour that she was. And Bloom always thinks that the southern people, Italians and Spanish, are more passionate. Spanish are half types that won't do things by halves. Passionate abandon of the south, casting every shred of decency to the winds. So that is Bloom musing, or in part perhaps also speaking. Okay.
Just bears out what I was saying, he with glowing bosom said to Stephen, and if I don't greatly mistake, she was Spanish too. The King of Spain's daughter, Stephen answered, adding something or other rather muddled about farewell and adieu to you Spanish onions, and the first land called the Dead Man, and from Ramhead to Scilly was so and so many. Was she? Bloom ejaculated, surprised, though not astonished by any means. I never heard that rumour before. Possible, especially there it was, as she lived there. So, Spain. Carefully avoiding a book in his pocket, sweets of, which reminded him, by the by, of that Cato Street Library book out of date, he took out his pocketbook, and turning over the various contents rapidly, finally he, do you consider, by the by, he said, thoughtfully selecting a faded photo which he laid on the table, that a Spanish type? Stephen, obviously addressed, looked down on the photo, showing a large-sized lady with her fleshy charms on evidence in an open fashion, as she was in the full bloom of womanhood, in evening dress, cut ostentatiously low for the occasion, to give a liberal display of bosom, with more than vision of breasts, her full lips parted, and some perfect teeth. Standing near, ostensibly with gravity, a piano, on the rest of which was In Old Madrid, a ballad, pretty in its way, which was then all the vogue. Her, the lady's, eyes, dark, large, looked at Stephen, about to smile about something to be admired. Lafayette of Westmoreland Street, Dublin's premier photographic artist, being responsible for the aesthetic execution. Mrs. Bloom, my wife, the prima donna, Madame Marion Tweedy, Bloom indicated, taken a few years since, in or about 96, very like her then. Beside the young man, he looked also at the photo of the lady, now his legal wife, who he intimated was the accomplished daughter of Major Brian Tweedy, and displayed at an early age remarkable proficiency as a singer, having even made her bow to the public when her years numbered barely sweet 16. As for the face, it was a speaking likeness in expression, but it did not do justice to her figure, which came in for a lot of notice usually, and which did not come out to the best advantage in that get-up. She could, without difficulty, he said, have posed for the ensemble, not to dwell on certain opulent curves of the... He dwelt, being a bit of an artist in his spare time, on the female form in general, developmentally, because, as it so happened, no later than that afternoon, he had seen those Grecian statues perfectly developed as works of art in the National Museum. Marble could give the original shoulders back, all the symmetry. All the rest, yes, Puritanism. It does, though, said Joseph Sovereign, whereas no photo could, because it simply wasn't art, in a word. This...
Oh. It bears out, just bears out of what I was saying. So he must have said something, it's not clear what. He, with glowing bosom, said to Stephen, and, if I don't greatly mistake, she was Spanish too, Katie O'Shea, or he wasn't. The King of Spain's daughter, Stephen answered, and Stephen, as we can see, doesn't listen at all, and he says something quite different that occurs to his mind. The King of Spain's daughter there, she's quoting something, adding something or other, rather muddled about, farewell adieu to my Spanish onions, for some reason, and the first grand is dead man from Rama to Sicily, or so and so many more. This is a jumble from various quotations that we don't have to go into. In other words, Stephen just pursues in his own way. There's very little, and that's the point here, communication between the two. Bloom trying very hard and Stephen being absent. So there's no great, as in Homer, recognition at all. Was she? Bloom ejaculated, and you can see here that the verbs of diction are varied in variation. You shouldn't repeat the same word, was one stylistic advice at the time. Ejaculate, of course, is religions, but it has obviously disturbing overtones. Though not astonished by any means. What is the difference between surprised and astonished? I never heard that rule before, possibly. Especially there it was, as she lived there. So, Spain. Of course, Molly has Spanish traits. Carefully avoiding a book in his pocket, sweets of, that he doesn't want to show, sweets of sin, which reminded him, by the way, of that Capuchin library book, out of date. Bloom remembers sometime he has taken a book from the Capel Street Library that he has to return, and he hasn't done that. He took out his pocketbook and, turning over the various contents rapidly, finally he, and the sentence isn't finished. Do you consider, by the by, he said, thoughtfully selecting a faded photograph which he laid on the table, that a Spanish type. So Bloom shows a picture of Molly. Stephen, obviously at rest, looked down on the photo showing a large-sized lady with her fleshy charms on evidence in an open fashion, as she was in the full bloom of womanhood, in evening dress, cut ostentatiously low for the occasion, to give a liberal display of bosom. That has been said a bit abundantly now, with more than vision of breasts. And I always wonder what the difference between bosom and vision of breasts is. Her full lips parted and some perfect teeth standing near, ostensibly with gravity, piano, on the rest of which was In Old Madrid, a song with a Spanish subject, a ballad, pretty in its way, which was then all the rogue. Her, the lady's, eyes, dark, large, looked at Stephen, about to smile, or something admired, Lafayette, of Westmoreland Street, Dublin's premier photographic artist, being responsible for the aesthetic execution. So there is obviously a professional photo for Molly Bloom as a singer in evening dress and all of that. And at the time, Lafayette was the photographer of Dublin. When we went there to see, we still saw some names, but it has disappeared. But it was really the best photographer of Dublin. Aesthetic execution is also a little bit doubtful here, you can see. Mr. Bloom, Mrs. Bloom, my wife, the prima donna, Madame Marion Tweedy, Bloom indicated, taken a few since, in or about 96. Very like her then. Beside the young man, he looked also at the photo of the lady, now his legal wife, who, he intimated, was the accomplished daughter of Major Brian Tweedy, and displayed at an early age remarkable proficiency as a singer, having even made her bow to the public when her years numbered barely sweet 17. As for the face, it was a speaking likeness, that's the idiom you use, a speaking likeness in expression, but it did not do justice to her figure. We always say about the photo, it doesn't do justice to something, which came in, the figure, for a lot of notice, usually, and which did not come out to the best advantage in that get-up. She could, without difficulty, he said, have posed for the ensemble. My guess is there's a touch of French coming in. In the tout ensemble means naked. So maybe that's what Bloom means here. Not to dwell on certain opulent curves of the, remember the opulent curves are an echo of Sweets of Sin, which he carries, where there's an erotic scene, the opulent curves. He dwelt, not to dwell on Gerard's curves, he dwelt, being a bit of an artist in his spare time, on the female form in general, developmentally. That is kind of almost photographic jargon, because, as it so happened, no later than that afternoon, he had seen those Grecian statues, perfectly developed as work of art in the National Museum. Now, what happened, of course, he had wanted to look at the backside of a Greek goddess, not her front, and couldn't do it. And then he says marble could give the original shoulders back. So he thinks the difficulty, a difference between photography and statues, they're different things. And of course, for a long time, there was a question whether photography could or could not be an art. Anyone here, shoulders back, all the symmetry. And then there's something strange here, where we don't quite know what it is. All the rest, yes, Puritanism, of course, they're down on nakedness. It does, though, and then we don't really know what is meant here. St. Joseph's Sovereign and some editions have a bit of French in them, the Garber edition, which was left out then later on. Whereas no photo could, because it simply wasn't art, in a word. Yeah, that's where we are.
The spirit moving him, he would much have liked to follow Jack Tar's good example and leave the likeness there for a very few minutes to speak for itself on the plea he, so that the other could drink in the beauty for himself, her stage presence being frankly a treat in itself, which the camera could not at all do justice to. But it was scarcely professional etiquette, so though it was a warm, pleasant sort of a night now, yet wonderfully cool for the season, considering the sunshine after storm, and he did feel a kind of need there and then to follow suit like a kind of inward voice and satisfy a possible need by moving a motion. Nevertheless, he sat tight, just viewing the slightly soiled photo, creased by opulent curves, none the worse for wear, however, and looked away thoughtfully with the intention of not further increasing the other's possible embarrassment while gauging her symmetry of heaving embonpoint. In fact, the slight soiling was only an added charm, like the case of linen slightly soiled, good as new, much better, in fact, with the starch out. Suppose she was gone when he... I look for the lamp, would you tell me, came into his mind, but merely as a passing fancy of his, because he then recollected the morning-littered bed, etc., and the book about Ruby with metempsychosis, sick, in it, which must have fell down sufficiently appropriately beside the domestic chamber pot, with apologies to Lindley Murray.
The spirit moving him, he would much have liked to follow Jack Tars, the sailors who went out, remember, to urinate, Jack Tar, good example, and leave the likeness there for a moment to speak for itself. Remember, he said, it was a speaking likeness, and now it says, leave the photo and to leave the likeness to speak for itself. So again, it's a certain reduplication and awkwardness. So that the other could drink in the beauty for himself, her stage present being, frankly, a treat in itself, which the camera could not at all do justice to, which had we heard that again. So it is four echoes that are probably due to a kind of tiredness. But it was scarcely professional etiquette. So, Sunday I remark about the weather, though it was a warm, pleasant sort of a night, not yet wonderfully cool for the season, considering for sunshine after storm, certainly a thought about the weather includes. And he did feel a kind of need there and then to follow suit, to also go out and do it himself, like a kind of inward voice and satisfy a possible need by moving emotion. Move emotion is a parliamentary language. And we heard the beginning was the spirit moving him. Nevertheless, he sat tight, just beyond the slightly soiled potato creased by opulent curves. Opulent curves are again the echo from the Speech of Sin. None the worse for wear, however, and looked away thoughtfully with the intention of not further increasing the other's possible embarrassment. The photo was creased and he does want to increase the thing. So you have these, and I think everybody who has ever written something or spoken for that matter, but often we use the same or a similar word too close together. Creased, increasing. The other's possible embarrassment while gauging her symmetry, if even en bon point. Why is that there? Remember that Bloom in the newspaper office thought about spelling difficulties in English, and one of the words is embarrassment. Does it have two or one R's or two or one S's? We're gauging the symmetry, so this is from that spelling riddle earlier in the day. Of heaving en bon point, and that is again an echo from Sweets of Sin that he opened in the book. So, in fact, that slight soiling was only an added charm, like the case of linen slightly soiled. So Bloom has a kind of penchant for this kind of soiling, and we now know from letters by Joyce that have survived, their erotic letters to Nora in Trieste long ago, that he also liked a kind of soiled underwear and things like that. Anyway, slightly so, good as new, much better in fact, with the starch out. And then there's a difficult, suppose she was gone when he, now he says, suppose, and usually returns, or the husband coming back, but the wife might have gone in the meantime. Suppose you're going, he, I looked for the lamb which he told me came into his mind. And this is actually a quotation from a song. which says, a husband came home and I looked for the lamp, which she told me would be there. Whereas without the quotation, we wouldn't understand the quotation. We wouldn't understand it. I look for the lamb, which she told me is quotation, came into his mind. So Bloom remembers a bit of that song, but merely for a passing fancy, because he then recollected the morning littered bed, etc. He remembers in the morning, the bed was littered, all kinds of clothing was there, etc. And the book about Ruby, remember the book that Molly was reading, Ruby, the Pride of the Ring, had fallen under the bed with metempsychosis, and it was the word metempsychosis in the book that Molly wanted to show him, but she called it metempsychosis, sick. That is, that's how it was. You know the convention of sick in parentheses when you want to say something. It looks odd, but it should be like that. The person quoted had made a mistake, but like a sick. In it with, which must have fell down. And you realize that Molly said the book, it must have fell down, not fallen down. Sufficient appropriately beside a domestic chamber pot, with apologies to Lindley Murray. Who is Lindley Murray? Lindley Murray was a well-known grammar. And of course, the word it must have fell down instead of fallen would be disapproved. And so with apology, you would say to duden in German and something. Like that. Yeah. So, it's a mistake. And that is how the grammar comes in. Okay.
The vicinity of the young man, he certainly relished, educated, distingué, and impulsive into the bargain, far and away the pick of the bunch, though you wouldn't think he had it in him. Yet you would. Besides, he said the picture was handsome, which, say what you like, it was, though at the moment she was distinctly stouter. And why not? An awful lot of make-believe went on about that sort of thing, involving a lifelong slur with the usual splash page of letterpress about the same old matrimonial tangle alleging misconduct with professional golfer or the newer stage favourite, instead of being honest and above board about the whole business. How they were fated to meet, and an attachment sprang up between the two, so that their names were coupled in the public eye, was told in court, with letters containing the habitual mushy and compromising expressions, leaving no loophole, to show that they openly cohabited two or three times a week at some well-known seaside hotel, and relations, when the thing ran its normal course, became in due course intimate. Then the decree nisi, and the king's proctor to show cause why, and he failing to quash it, nisi was made absolute. But as for that, the two misdemeanants, wrapped up as they largely were in one another, could safely afford to ignore it, as they very largely did, till the matter was put in the hands of the solicitor, who filed a petition for the party wronged in due course. He, Bloom, enjoyed the distinction of being close to Aaron's uncrowned king in the flesh when the thing occurred on the historic fracas, when the fallen leaders, who notoriously stuck to his guns to the last drop, even when clothed in the mantle of adultery, leaders, trusty henchmen, to the number of 10 or a dozen or possibly even more than that, penetrated into the printing works of the insuppressible, or no, it was United Ireland, and by no means, by the by, appropriate appellative, and broke up the typecases with hammers or something like that, all on account of some scurrilous effusions from the facile pens of the O'Brienite scribes at the usual mudslinging occupation, reflecting on the erstwhile tribune's private morals. Though palpably a radically altered man, he was still a commanding figure, though carelessly garbed as usual, with that look of settled purpose which went a long way with the shilly-shallyers till they discovered to their vast discomfiture that their idol had feet of clay, after placing him upon a pedestal, which she, however, was the first to perceive. As those were particularly hot times in the general hullabaloo, Bloom sustained a minor injury from a nasty prod of some chap's elbow in the crowd that, of course, congregated, lodging someplace about the pit of the stomach, fortunately not of a grave character. His hat, Parnell's, was inadvertently knocked off, and as a matter of strict history, Bloom was the man who picked it up in the crush after witnessing the occurrence, meaning to return it to him, and return it to him he did with the utmost celerity, who, panting and hatless, and whose thoughts were miles away from his hat at the time, being a gentleman born with a stake in the country, he, as a matter of fact, having gone into it more for the kudos of the thing than anything else, was bred in the bone, instilled into him in infancy at his mother's knee, in the shape of knowing what good form was, came out at once because he turned round to the donor and thanked him with perfect aplomb, saying, "Thank you, sir," though in a very different tone of voice from the ornament of the legal profession, whose headgear Bloom also set to rights earlier in the course of the day, history repeating itself with a difference, after the burial of a mutual friend, when they had left him alone in his glory after the grim task of having committed his remains to the grave.
Oh, the usual language, of course. The vicinity of the young man he certainly relished. Educated, distingué, and impulsive into the bargain, though Stephen isn't very impulsive here, far and away the pick of the bunch. Though you wouldn't think he had it in him, yet you would. "Besides," he said, "the picture was handsome. So, Stephen, obviously you must say something handsome, which, say what you like, it was, though at the moment she was distinctly stout on. And why not? An awful lot of make-believe went out about that sort of thing, involving a lifelong slur with the usual splash page of the letterpress about the same old matrimonial tangle. He can't get away from that Parnell adultery case, obviously because in a similar situation, so he keeps repeating it, alleging misconduct with professional golfer. There were, of course, court cases where upper-class ladies had affairs with professional golfers, or the newest stage favourite, instead of being honest and above board about the whole business. And then again, he rehearses the Parnell case, how they were fated to meet and an attachment sprung up between the two so that their names were coupled in the public eye, was told in court with letters containing the habitual mushy and compromising expressions. And of course, evidence for adultery is usually love letters that are quoted, leaving no loophole to show that they openly cohabited two or three times a week at some well-known seaside hotel that was usually in Brighton, by the way. For some reason, such affairs often were conducted in Brighton, not in London. And relations, when the thing ran its normal course, became in due course intimate. Then the decree, nisi, at the King Proctor to show cause why. When there is a divorce case and it's sort of proved, there is the divorce is not yet valid, but there is a period, and that's called nisi prius, when there's new evidence coming, unless there is new evidence coming. And so there's a period of a few weeks until the case becomes absolute. And Bloom knows that obviously from the newspapers. And the King's Proctor, that is the legal person who does it, to show cause why, and he failing, quash it. Nisi was made absolute. So there's a nisi and a decree absolute. And Bloom has some idea, though he confuses the terms. But as for that, the two misdemeanants, wrapped up as a large were in each in one another, could safely afford to ignore it, as they were largely did, till the matter was put in the hands of a solicitor, comes to law, who filed a petition for the party wronged in due course. And now Bloom tells again the story we've already heard, that he wants in a crowd was close to Parnell and picked up his hat. I think we read that last week or the week before. He, Bloom, enjoyed the distinction of being close to Erin's uncrowned king. That was the name given to Parnell of his death in the flesh. When the thing occurred in the historic fracas, when the fallen leaders, who notoriously stuck to his guns, that's a military expression, of course, to the last drop, that's another, you fight to the last drop, that's another military, when clothed in the mantle of adultery. And then it comes back, the leaders, trusty henchmen to the number of 10 or a dozen, or possibly even more. 10 or a dozen, or possibly even more, is also typical than that, penetrated into the printing works of the insuppressible. It was the United Ireland, by no means, by the by, appropriate appellative, because Ireland was never united, and broke up the typecases with hammers or something. Like that, all on account of some scurrilous effusion from the facile pen of the O'Brienite. O'Brien was an adherent of Parnell, and then he turned against him. And again, as I probably said, it is important to have the press in your hands. Nowadays, it will be television. And so the Parnell people wanted to take back the newspapers. That happened really. O'Brien scribes, at the usual mudslinging occupation, reflecting on the erstwhile tribune's private morals, Parnell's private. No, palpably, palpably is also not a good, because palpably means you touch, and there's no touching here. Palpably, a radically altered man, he was still a commanding figure. Though carelessly garbed, as usual, with that look of settled purpose which went a long way with the shilly-shalliers till they discovered to their vast discomfiture that their idol had feet of clay. Again, that was said before, the statue in the Old Testament, tournerne füße, feet of clay, the weak point, after placing it upon a pedestal, which she, was the first to perceive. As those were particularly hot times in the general hullabaloo, Bloom sustained a minor injury from a nasty prod of some chap's elbow in the crowd that, of course, congregated, lodging some place about the pit of the stomach. So Bloom had some injury. Fortunately, not of a grave character. His hat, Parnell's, was inadvertently knocked off, and as a matter of strict history, Bloom was the man who picked it up in the cross after witnessing the occurrence, meaning to return it to him, and return it to him he did with the utmost celerity. Who, panting and hatless, and whose thoughts were miles away from his hat at the time, being a gentleman born with a stake in the country, he, as a matter of fact, having gone into it more for the kudos of the thing, kudos means the glory for it, of the thing than anything else, what's bred in the bone, what you pick up early, or what is your DNA, instilled to him in infancy at his mother's knee in the shape of knowing what good form was. And you realize that when instilled him in infancy, he was bred like that, at his mother's knee in the shape of knowing what's good for him. So you suddenly get the mother's knee in a shape, which of course is a wrong lead. It's not the shape of the knee, but the construction leads to that. Knowing what good form was came out at once, because he turned round to the donor and thanked him with perfect aplomb, saying, "Thank you, sir." And I realized something. Bloom has told it or thought of it twice. And the first time, Parnell said, "Thank you." And he says, "Thank you, sir." That's not a big difference. But he only said one of the two forms. And I think if you really rub shoulders with history, with a great man, a great political leader, you might as well remember the exact words. It probably did happen, I mean, in the fiction. But it doesn't quite tally. Though in a very different tone of voice from that, the ornament of the legal profession, whose get here Bloom also said to write early in the course of the history of pleading with a difference after the burial of a friend, where they had left him alone in his glory after grim talk of having committed his remains to the grave. Now, what Bloom does here, though it may not be immediately obvious, Bloom thinks Parnell's hat that he picked up led to "thank you, sir," whereas in the morning where he saw the lawyer Menton and said his dent in his hat, he also said "thank you," but in a very curt, impolite way. So Bloom compares the two events, what happened to him in the morning and what happened on a historic occasion. But Bloom, in a way, was close to real history.
On the other hand, what incensed him more inwardly was the blatant jokes of the cabman and so on, who passed it all off as a jest, laughing immoderately, pretending to understand everything, the why and the wherefore, and in reality, not knowing their own minds, it being a case for the two parties themselves, unless it ensued that the legitimate husband happened to be a party to it, owing to some anonymous letter from the usual boy Jones, who happened to come across them at the crucial moment in a loving position, locked in one another's arms, drawing attention to their illicit proceedings and leading up to a domestic rumpus, and the erring fair one begging forgiveness of her lord and master upon her knees, and promising to sever the connection and not receive his visits any more, if only the aggrieved husband would overlook the matter and let bygones be bygones, with tears in her eyes, though possibly with her tongue in her fair cheek at the same time, as quite possibly there were several others. He personally, being of a sceptical bias, believed, and didn't make the smallest bones about saying so either, that man or men, in the plural, were always hanging around on the waiting list about a lady, even supposing she was the best wife in the world, and they got on fairly well together for the sake of argument, when, neglecting her duties, she chose to be tired of wedded life, and was on for a little flutter in polite debauchery to press their attentions on her with improper intent, the upshot being that her affection centred on another, the cause of any liaison between still attractive married women getting on for fair and 40 and younger men, no doubt as several famous cases of feminine infatuation proved up to the hilt. It was a thousand pities a young fellow blessed with an allowance of brains, as his neighbour obviously was, should waste his valuable time with profligate women who might present him with a nice dose to last him his lifetime. In the nature of single blessedness, he would one day take unto himself a wife when Miss Wright came on the scene. But in the interim, lady society was a conditio sine qua non, though he had the gravest possible doubts, not that he wanted in the smallest to pump Stephen about Miss Ferguson, who was very possibly the particular lodestar who brought him down to Irishtown so early in the morning, as to whether he would find much satisfaction basking in the boy and girl courtship idea, and the company of smirking misses without a penny to their names, bi or tri-weekly, with the orthodox preliminary canter of compliment paying and walking out, leading up to fond lovers' ways and flowers and chocks. To think of him house and homeless, rooked by some landlady worse than any stepmother, was really too bad at his age. The queer suddenly things he popped out with attracted the elder man, who was several years the other senior, or like his father. But something substantial he certainly ought to eat, were it only an egg flip made on unadulterated maternal nutriment, or failing that, the homely Humpty Dumpty boiled. "At what o'clock did you dine?" he questioned of the slim form and tired though unwrinkled face. "Sometime yesterday," Stephen said. "Yesterday," exclaimed Bloom, till he remembered it was already tomorrow, Friday. "Ah, you mean it's after 12. The day before yesterday. Stephen said, improving on himself.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I lost my passage. Yeah. On the other hand, what incensed him more inwardly was the blatant jokes of the cabmen and so on, who passed it all off as a jest, laughing immoderately, pretending to understand everything, the why and the wherefore, and in reality not knowing their own minds, it being a case for the two parties themselves, unless it ensued that the legitimate husband happened to be a party to it. Now, in some way, that's Bloom's situation. The husband, the legitimate husband, in a way, is allowing the affair with Boyland to happen. The legitimate husband happened to be a part to it owing to some anonymous letter from the usual boy Jones. That is somebody who betrays something in a theater or in a play or what, who happened to come across them at the crucial moment in a loving position, locked in one another's arms. So that is usually what witnesses would say in a divorce case, drawing attention to their illicit proceedings and leading up to a domestic rumpus, and the erring fair one begging forgiveness of her lord and master upon her knees and promising to sever the connections and not receive his visit anymore, if only the aggrieved husband would overlook the matter and let bygones be bygones, with tears in her eyes, though possibly with her tongue in her fair cheek. And you know, tongue in cheek means you say something that you don't mean. I mean, when you express that what you say is meant in a different way. Tongue in her fair cheek. At the same time, as quite possibly there were several others. He, personally, and again, I draw attention, what on earth does the word personally add to the sentence? He, personally, being of a skeptical bias, believed, and that's also funny, be skeptical and then believed together, and didn't make the smallest bones about saying it's either that man or men in the plural were always hanging around on the waiting list about the lady. Even supposing she was the best wife in the world and they got on fairly well together for the sake of argument. Now, again, here you can see something. They don't get well together for the sake of argument, but you say something, likely or unlikely, you say it for the sake of argument. So that is part of the frame. When, neglecting her duties, she chose to be tired of wedding life and was on for a little fluttering of polite debauchery to press her attention on her with improper intent. That's again legal language. The upshot being that her affection centered on another, the cause of many liaisons, realize the many foreign words, between still attractive married women, getting on for fair and 40, that's also a quotation. Molly is about 33, and younger men, no doubt, as several famous cases of feminine infatuation proved up to the hilt. So there's another phrase then. Oh, sorry, it was a thousand pities a young fellow blessed with an allowance of brain, as his neighbour obviously was, should waste his valuable time with profligate women, who might present him with a nice dose of disease to last him his lifetime. In the nature of single blessedness, another quotation, he would one day take unto himself a wife when Miss Wright came on the scene. But in the interim, lady society was a conditio sine qua non. That's an elaborate Latin for a necessary condition. Though it's quite common, you don't have you can show your erudition by quoting this. Though he had the gravest possible doubts, not that he wanted in the smallest to pump Stephen about Miss Ferguson, who was very possible the particular lodestar who brought him down to Irish Town so early in the morning. And you see here we have an occurrence of Bloom's misunderstanding what happened, and I go back to it just to remind you, it's a long time back, when Bloom, was bent over Stephen, who was knocked down, and Stephen came too. And he quoted the poem by which says, "Who drive Fergus now?" and so on. That Stephen Bloom thinks that Stephen's girlfriend was a Miss Ferguson. It's an error, and here it comes up again. And of course, that would be a good thing for Stephen. Well, as to whether he would find much satisfaction in basking the boy and girl courtship idea and the company of smirking misses without a penny to their names, bi or triweekly, with the orthodox familiar candor of compliment paying and walking out and leading up to fond lovers' raid and flowers and chocolates. To think of him house and homeless, rooked by some landlady, cheated by some landlady, worse than ever, than any stepmother, was really too bad at his age. The queer, sunny things he popped out with, Stephen comes out with some strange sayings, attracted the older man, who was several years the senior, or like his father, and here the relation of Bloom and Stephen as a kind of father and son is reinforced. There are some readers, quite many, who think the most important thing in this book is a father-son relationship. That anyway, Bloom, whose son died, does find a substitute son in Stephen. But I can't see Stephen very much looking for a father. But I mean, that's one of the themes in the book. But something substantial he certainly ought to eat. Were it only an egg flip made on adulterated maternal nutriment, or failing that, the homely Humpty Dumpty boiled. Instead of an egg, a boiled egg, he says Humpty Dumpty and things like that. So Bloom is very paternal, I think. Stephen should eat something. What Stephen wants is an alcoholic drink, and he can't get that. At what o'clock did you dine? That's also a more elaborate way of saying it. Bloom may be thinking he can impress Stephen by a refined diction. At what o'clock did you dine? He questioned of the slim form and tired, though unwrinkled, face. Sometime yesterday, Stephen said. Yesterday, exclaimed Bloom, till he remembered it was already tomorrow, Friday. And you know that time after midnight, when in a way you still have the day before, though it's the next day, and today is actually already tomorrow, Friday. Oh, you mean it's after 12? The day before yesterday, Stephen said, improving on himself. So Stephen hasn't eaten much. And I say Bloom's feeling are paternal or maternal or whatever.
improving on himself. Literally astounded at this piece of intelligence, Bloom reflected. Though they didn't see eye to eye in everything, a certain analogy there somehow was, as if both their minds were traveling, so to speak, in the one train of thought. At his age, when dabbling in politics, roughly some score of years previously, when he had been a quasi-aspirant to parliamentary honours in the Buckshot Foster days, he too recollected in retrospect, which was a source of keen satisfaction in itself. He had a sneaking regard for those same ultra-ideas. For instance, when the evicted tenants question, then at its first inception, bulked largely in people's minds, though, it goes without saying, not contributing a copper or pinning his faith absolutely to its dictums, some of which wouldn't exactly hold water, he at the outset, in principle, at all events, was in thorough sympathy with peasant possession, as voicing the trend of modern opinion, a partiality, however, which, realizing his mistake, he was subsequently partially cured of, and even was twitted with going a step further than Michael Davitt in the striking views he at one time inculcated as a back to the lander, which was one reason he strongly resented the innuendo put upon him in so barefaced a fashion at the gathering of the clans in Barney Kiernan's, so that he, though often considerably misunderstood and the least pugnacious of mortals, be it repeated, departed from his customary habit to give him, metaphorically, one in the gizzard. Though as far as politics themselves were concerned, he was only too conscious of the casualties invariably resulting from propaganda and displays of mutual animosity and the misery and suffering it entailed as a foregone conclusion on fine young fellows, chiefly destruction of the fittest, in a word. Anyhow, upon weighing the pros and cons, getting on for one as it was high time to be retiring for the night. The crux was, it was a bit risky to bring him home, as eventualities might possibly ensue, somebody having a temper of her own sometimes, and spoil the hash altogether, as on the night he misguidedly brought home a dog, breed unknown, with a lame paw. Not that the cases were either identical or the reverse, though he had hurt his hand too, to Ontario Terrace, as he very distinctly remembered having been there, so to speak. On the other hand, it was altogether far and away too late for the Sandy Mount or Sandy Cove suggestion, so that he was in some perplexity as to which of the two alternatives. Everything pointed to the fact that it behoved him to avail himself to the full of the opportunity, all things considered. His initial impression was that he was a bit standoffish or not over-effusive, but it grew on him some way. For one thing, he mightn't what you call jump at the idea if approached, and what most worried him was he didn't know how to lead up to it or word it exactly. Supposing he did entertain the proposal, as it would afford him very great personal pleasure if he would allow him to help to put coin in his way or some wardrobe, if found suitable. At all events, he wound up by concluding, eschewing for the nonce hidebound precedent, a cup of Epps cocoa and a shakedown for the night, plus the use of a rug or two and overcoat doubled into a pillow. At least he would be in safe hands and as warm as toast on a trivet. He failed to perceive any very vast amount of harm in that, always with the proviso, no rumpus of any sort was kicked up. A move had to be made, because that merry old soul, the grass widower in question, who appeared to be glued to the spot, didn't appear in any particular hurry to wend his way home to his dearly beloved Queenstown, and it was highly likely some sponger's bawdy house of retired beauties off Sherwood Street Lower would be the best clue to that equivocal character's whereabouts for a few days to come. Alternately racking their feelings, the mermaids, with six-chamber revolver anecdotes verging on the tropical, calculated to freeze the marrow of anybody's bones and mauling their large-sized charms between whiles with rough-and-tumble gusto to the accompaniment of large potations of potcheen, and the usual blarney about himself, for as to who he in reality was, let XX equal my right name and address, as Mr. Algebra remarks passing. At the same time, he inwardly chuckled over his repartee to the Blood and Oons champion about his god being a Jew. People could put up with being bitten by a wolf, but what properly riled them was a bite from a sheep. The most vulnerable point, too, of tender Achilles, your god was a Jew, because mostly they appeared to imagine he came from Carrick and Shannon or somewhere about in the County Sligo.
Then we have another use of that literally, which isn't literal, literally astounded by this piece of intelligence, Bloom reflected. Though they didn't see eye to eye in everything, a certain analogy there somehow was, as if both their minds were travelling, so to speak, in the one train of thought. You realize, travelling in a train one train of thought. At his age, when dabbling in politics roughly some score of years previously, when he had been a quasi-aspirant to parliamentary honours in the Boxford Foster days, so Bloom obviously had, younger, had some ideas in engaging in politics, which of course he didn't. The Boxford Foster was the English secretary in Ireland who used Boxford, that is, what do you call it in German? I forget now, against the insurgents. Which was a source of keen infarction in itself. He had a sneaking regard for the same ultra ideas. So Bloom had once thought of politics. For instance, when the evicted tenants question, which already were mentioned, then at its first inception is also a bit tautological. Inception is something that's first. Bulks largely in people's minds, though, it goes without saying, not contributing a couple of pennies absolutely to its dictums, some of which wouldn't exactly hold water. He, at the outset, in principle, at all events, was in thorough sympathy with peasant possessions, that is, that the peasants, the tenants, should have something they own. As voicing the trend of modern opinion, a partiality, however, which, realizing his mistake, he was subsequently partially cured of, and even was treated with going a step farther than Michael Davitt. Michael Davitt was the one who concerned himself with peasants and tenants problems, a political figure. In the striking views, he had one time incorporated as a back to the land, and that was a movement back to the land, away from the cities. You can find out all these things, of course, now very easily. Which was one reason he strongly rejected the innuendo put upon him in so barefaced a fashion at the gathering of the clans in Barney Kiernan's, so he well remembers events in the Cyclop chapter, that he, though often considerably misunderstood, and the last pugnacious of mortals, he's repeated, departed from his customary habit to give him metaphorically, not really, one in the gizzard, one in the face. So, though as far as politics himself were concerned, he was only too conscious of the casualties invariably resulting from the propaganda and displays of mutual animosity and the misery and suffering it entailed, as a foregone conclusion, on fine fellows, chiefly the destruction of the fittest in the world. And here you can see, of course, Darwinian terms, the survival of the fittest, and here now it is that in war the fittest will be destroyed. Now, I don't think we can manage the whole, but we'll go as far as we can. Anyhow, upon weighing the pros and cons, getting on for one as it was, it was high time, and you may notice that something goes wrong syntactically when you say, upon weighing the pros and cons, you expect Bloom as a subject. But it says, it's getting on for it was high time, so the upon weighing the pros and cons is syntactically dangling. But we understand it. It was high time to return for the night. The crux was, it was a bit risky to bring him home, as eventualities might possibly ensue, somehow having a temper of her own sometimes, and spoil the hash altogether, as on the night he misguidedly brought home a dog, Breed Unknown, with a lame paw, Not that the cases were as identical as the worst, though he had hurt his hand too, in To Ontario Terrace, as he very distinctly remembered, having been there, so to speak. On the other hand, it was altogether far and away too late for the sandy mount or sandy coast suggestion. The tower is in Sandy Cove, and Sandy Cove and Sandy Mount can be easily confused. And that is, will be far away. So Bloom thinks Stephen couldn't possibly walk. Would be, as I perhaps said, would be about 3 hours. Not that they didn't walk that much at the time. Anyway, there's that. So that he was in some perplexity as to which of the two alternatives. Now, you also know two alternatives is tautological, because an alternative is the second choice. Everything pointed to the fact that it behoved him to avail himself to the full of the opportunity, all things considered. His initial impression was that he was a bit standoffish, Stephen is, and not over effusive, and Stephen hasn't been very responsive, but it grew on him some way. For one thing, he mightn't be what you call, though he mightn't what you call jump at the idea, if approached. And what mostly worried him was he didn't know how to lead up to it or word it exactly. How do you phrase an invitation? Bloom is always very hesitant about it. He's not good at that. How to say it, word it exactly. Supposing he did entertain a proposal, and what he might have said is what you would normally say, as it would afford him very great personal pleasure if you would allow him to help to put coin his way or some wardrobe. So the usual phrase is, come to my home and my wife would have great personal pleasure, which of course is never true. So Bloom wants to invite Stephen, but doesn't quite know how to phrase it, if found suitable. At all events, he wound up by concluding, eschewing for the nonce hideabout precedence, a cup of Epsis cocoa. That was very much in him. And a shakedown for the night, plus the use of a rug or two, and overcoat doubled into a pillow. At least he would be in safe hands, and as warm as a toast on a trivet. You can be as warm as a toast, a trivet, and the phrase is, you're as safe as a trivet. A trivet has only three legs, and it doesn't wobble. So the two idioms are confused. Warm as a toast and safe as a trivet. Toasts you don't usually put on trivets. He failed to pursue any vast amount of harm in that. Always the proviso, no rumpus of any sort was kicked up, that the wife wouldn't be angry. A move had to be made, because that very old soul, the grass widower in question, the sailor, who appeared to be glued to the spot, didn't appear in any particular hurry to wend his way home to his dearly beloved Queenstown. And it was highly likely some sponsored boarding house of a tribute of sheriffs to lower would be the best clue to that equivocal character's whereabouts for a few days to come. Alternatively, racking their feelings, the mermaids, he would be in some cheap lodgings with six chamber revolver anecdotes, the kind of stories he made up, verging on the tropical, calculated to freeze the marrow of anybody's bones, and mauling their outside charms between that with rough and tundle gusto, to the accompaniment of large potatoes of poteen. Poteen is whiskey that is distilled at home. It's illicit whiskey, and probably not very good one either. and the usual blarney about himself for as to who he really was. We don't know. Let X equal the right name address, as Mr. Algebra remarks, passing. And of course, X is the unknown that you have to refer. So we don't really know who he is. I say X, the unknown in algebra. So Mr. Algebra is called up. At the same time, he inwardly chuckled over his repartee to the blood and ounce champion, that is the citizen in the Cyclops chapter, about his God being a Jew, which Broom said. People could put up with being bitten by a wolf, but what popped around them was a bite from a sheep. And ironically, the citizen called Broom a wolf in sheep's clothing. And then the most modern point to have tender Achilles, and I've already mentioned the earlier in the day, the keeper of the shelter pointed out to the heel or tendon of Achilles and pointed it out. And now the tendon Achilles, Achilles ferse, becomes tender Achilles. And as you may know from the Iliad, Achilles was not tender at all. He was a fierce warrior. Your God was a Jew, because mostly they appear to imagine he, Jesus, came from Carriage and Shannon or somewhere about the country, Sligo. Of course, Jesus was a Jew, but for the good Catholics, they think he must have been a kind of native Irishman from Sligo in the country. Yeah, I think then we can stop here. Yeah, good. And getting close to the end of the chapter. Then thank you for listening, and all the best until next time.
Thank you. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everyone.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.